The grayness in their skin was an artifact of the oxygen transport. The blackness of their eyes was an optical structure that was better at capturing light. Whatever was going on with the new kind of neurons in their brains and the extra layer in their neocortexes, all the old, purely human structures were there too. The process of recreating all that using tools out of the protomolecule's toolbox was an act of hubris that took her breath away. If anyone besides Duarte and Cortázar had been part of that conversation, there would have been prosecution. Two men, each convinced of their exceptionalism, were capable of leapfrogging over vast chasms of maybe this isn't a great idea and this is totally illegal. Elvi had become convinced that Cortázar was jealous that Duarte had intended to feed his own daughter into the same grinder instead of his pet scientist. She levered herself up on her cane and walked to the transparent cage. The boy stepped back, like he was afraid of her. The girl, Kara, stood her ground. Development into a mature form wasn't the same as aging and death. Maybe the drones hadn't understood that. So that meant something about how the protomolecule designers had functioned, didn't it? That their designs didn't take growth and maturation into account suggested that the original designers only had mature forms. Adults making adults. She tried to imagine what that would be like. "Can I ask you something?" Elvi said. For a moment, Kara was still as stone. When she nodded, it felt like watching a statue come to life. "Did you and your brother lose time? When the thing happened, and we could see the air?" "Yes, then." "I don't know. He doesn't give us a clock to look at." "You're conscious, then. You and your brother are sentient. Self-aware?" The huge black eyes changed, glimmered. A thick tear rolled down Kara's cheek. Elvi put her palm against the cage. "I'm sorry," she said. "I am so, so sorry." Chapter 30. Bobby. Bobby couldn't sleep. This was a new thing, or at least one that she didn't remember from when she was young. Back when she'd been active duty with the MMC, she'd been able to close her eyes and lose consciousness whenever a few minutes presented themselves. The idea of lying on a cot in a converted office, staring up at the ceiling, strapped lightly to keep from launching herself out of bed given Callisto's mild gravity, it wouldn't have made sense to that Bobby Draper. But here she was, 3 hours into her sleep cycle, making an inventory of her muscles and forcing each tense one to relax. A live monitor on the desk's surface threw flickers of light and darkness above her. She noticed the tension that had crept back into her shoulders and made herself release it for the 4th or 5th or 25th time. She closed her eyes and willed them to stay closed. Something in the hallway dripped. Condensation that might mean a failure in the heating system or in the air recyclers. She tried to ignore it. Her crew was scattered through Callisto Station, or on the storm, or in their own cots in the complex of smugglers' caves. It made her anxious to have her people diffused out into the civilian population like that. It also made her anxious to have them all together, where they'd make a single target. The Laconian security forces only needed one lucky break. She needed all of them. Her shoulders were tense again. Fuck. She undid the restraint with one hand and hauled herself up. Maybe an hour in the storm's gym would get her past the worst of her insomnia. But on the way out toward the hangar, she stopped at the desk, checking again the way she did 50 times a day. The map was broken into two frames. The smaller one showed the relative positions of the major bodies and soul system, tracking the inevitable and predictable change in cartography like an orrery. The larger showed the Jovian system in great detail, with data copied from the traffic control logs. On the small screen, Jupiter and its moons looked calm and serene, passing through the vastness of space with the tranquil beauty of the inevitable. Closer up, it was like a beehive. Hundreds of ships, from ancient rockhoppers and mining skiffs to the Tempest and everything in between. It was the Tempest that drew her. Trejo had transferred out of the system on one of the fast Laconian shuttles, burning hard back to Laconia to deal with the crisis in the slow zone. The Tempest, on the other hand, had been sniffing around the Jovian moons like a dog searching for its lost antimatter. It had been in a complex orbit near Ganymede most of the time, though once it had darted out to Europa. It would come to Callisto eventually, and force her hand. Until then, the best she could do was take comfort in imagining the fresh new Laconian vice-admiral losing sleep in his cot because a moon-killing load of antimatter had gone missing, and it was his job to find it. She tapped the red dot on the map that was the Tempest. "Anything you can do, I can do better." An alert popped up. A news feed from Sirius Station with a breaking report. She opened it, and a young man with a lunar accent looked earnestly up at her from the desk. "This is Davis Miles with Sirius Beat. And behind me, you can see station security in cooperation with Laconian state intelligence agents securing a cell of criminal separatists here at the heart of Sirius Station, in what is being called the biggest bust since the Coalition joined the Laconian Association of Worlds." Bobby felt the tightness across her back get worse. It wasn't only that every loss to the underground was more risk to her and hers. She hated the way history was being rewritten before her eyes. Sol System joined the Association of Worlds was a hell of a way to say Laconia trucked in a half-alien warship and killed the shit out of everyone until we showed them our bellies. The time was coming when, even if she didn't hear from Naomi, she was going to have to make the ancient human decision again. Fight or flight. As the reporter enthused about how many guns and enemy soldiers had been captured, she cracked her knuckles. She had three options. Take on the Tempest, run for the gate, or destroy the storm and let her crew dissolve into the civilian population. Every option was its own kind of bad. The cell was exposed by the discovery of an encryption package running on a public system, the reporter said, and the feed kicked over to a wide-faced woman with a pattern of moles on her cheeks that looked like paint spatter. The activity of the decryption package coincided with a data drop from known separatist elements earlier today, she said, and Bobby killed the feed. She made a connection to Jillian. Her second-in-command accepted like she'd been expecting her. Before Jillian could speak, Bobby asked, "Did a bottle come through?" "It did," Jillian said. "We got a full copy of the data. I was going to let you sleep until the decryption run was finished." "We're running the decrypt on our own system, yeah?" "You saw the thing on Ceres," Jillian said. It wasn't a question. "Those yokels were stupid, and so they'll die. Good riddance. We're not stupid. We won't die." "How long before the data's clean?" Jillian shrugged. "Another hour, maybe." "I'll be in the gym," she said. "The minute it's done, I know it. Understood?" "Yeah, okay," Jillian said. And Bobby dropped the connection. Any hope of sleep was gone now. Her nerves were as bright as stars. She pulled the tactical map back up. The red dot of the Tempest was still near Ganymede. She stared at it for a long moment, as if the commander might be able to feel her attention, might be scared by it. She closed its display and went to the storm. The gym was bright and clean. All the equipment was Martian design, strained through Laconian technology. Bobby threw herself into the effort like it could help her forget, and it did, at least a little bit. She'd been in the resistance gel for 40 minutes when Jillian's message came through. The bottle had been from Oberon, from Naomi. It was the reply she'd been hoping for. Bobby, panting and wet from exertion, opened the message file. The background filter made Naomi look like she was in a featureless white room, like she was an angel delivering her message from some abstract heaven. Naomi tipped her head forward unconsciously before she spoke, the way she did when she was delivering bad news. "Hey, Bobby," she said. "Your plan looks solid." Bobby grinned until her cheeks ached. In his last days, her grandfather talked sometimes about how weirdly clear his early memories had become. He might not quite remember the name of his nurse or when the man had last been to check on him, but the details of his childhood were vivid and immediate, like the past was growing stronger as his present and future wore thin. He told the story about seeing a living cat for the first time, and how strange it had felt to hold it, with the same awe in his voice every time. Bobby's memory hadn't done that, not yet, but maybe there was something. When she called the crew back to the storm for her briefing, all she could think of was when she'd been back in the service on Mars. The leader of her first fire team had been Sergeant Huck. He'd been about half a head shorter than she was, with a terrier-thin face and a receding hairline. She'd never known anyone before or since who could command her loyalty or instill fear in her the way he had. When she'd been right out of boot and as green as they come, he'd turned her into an actual Marine. Before every mission briefing, he had found a way to acknowledge her. A nod, a touch on her shoulder or arm. Something that meant that no matter what was coming next, she wasn't going into it alone. He never humiliated her by saying it aloud, and he never left it unsaid. After he retired, she'd found out he'd done the same for everyone. Now, as her people returned to the ship, she did something similar. She stood in the airlock, seeing each of them as they boarded. Timon Kool, with his old OPA split-circle tattoo smudged by time, until it was just a bluish blotch on the back of his hand. Lisa Shu, with her pale gray hair. Caspar Asoau, looking like a teenager surrounded by his grandparents. Denise Liu, Scaldi Austin Bay, Ian Freeman, and, almost last, Alex Kamal. Alex, her oldest friend, and the man she'd traveled with for what felt like half a dozen lifetimes now. He looked weary, like she'd woken him from his sleep. Maybe she had. He wouldn't have complained. He paused in front of her, and for a moment it was like they were back on the Rosinante together. Like they were home. She touched his hand, and he nodded to her like he understood perfectly. Probably he did. When the crew was all assembled in the galley, she pulled up her map of the system. It filled the wall. Someone in the back coughed, and she realized she'd been looking at it for several long seconds, and that she was enjoying herself. "All right," she said. "We have word from on high. New mission, high risk, high reward." She shifted to an image of the Tempest. As strange as the storm was in its particulars, its architecture was essentially the same design language that Martian ships had been for decades before the starving years. The Tempest was something else. Pale, asymmetrical, with protrusions and curves more like some monstrous vertebra. "We are going to kill that." She waited for a moment, half expecting mutiny on the spot. The Tempest had put its boot on Sol System's neck without seeming to break a sweat. She could have said, "We're all going to turn ourselves inside out and become seagulls." and it might have seemed about as realistic. No one objected. Looking into their faces, she saw interest, anticipation. She saw hope, and she knew she'd been right to want this. "We have a small payload that will do the trick," she said, nodding to Rinny Glodden at the back. "Payload of what?" someone asked. "The magnetars run on antimatter," Bobby said. "The Tempest's resupply was on that freighter we took."
"Jesus," Casper said.
"Correct," Bobby replied. "But delivery will be difficult, and we're only going to get one shot. In our last mission, we found, along with this antimatter, replacement parts for a sensor array very similar to what the Storm's using. I've been over the battle footage, and I know the story is that the Tempest shook off everything the Earth-Mars Coalition threw at her. But," she laid out the schematic, "overlapping fields sprang out from the Tempest like peacock feathers on display. The range of sensor arrays." She tapped one, and it dropped out. "From the hit she took, and from how she's been flying since, I think this is the array they need a replacement for. And if the information we have is right, it means the Tempest has a blind spot here." She pulled the display out to showcase the thin cone of black where the enemy ship's eyes couldn't go. "And, if we're right about their need for antimatter, they won't be able to use the field projector, which means they'll be down to conventional weapons only." "Captain?" It was Casper. Jillian scowled at the boy like she was ready to punch him, but Bobby nodded him on. Even with just torpedoes and railguns, and even if there is a data hole there, they can still take us in a straight fight. And they'll still see us coming," Bobby said. "So, we let them see us. We get a Callistan shuttle. Private. Small. Doesn't even have an Epstein. And we put it out." She switched back to the image of Jupiter and its moons. A single bright blue dot appeared. "Here. And on an orbital path that looks like we're heading for Amalthea. A crew of two with a gas canister torpedo. Now, those are slow, yes, but they also run cold. Basically no heat signature."
"Bis bien," Timon said.
"Ran hundreds like back on Ceres, Sasa." Jillian's voice was harsh. "Could we not interrupt the captain?" "The hard part will be putting the Tempest into a flight pattern like this." A red arc appeared going from Ganymede. A line marked the time at each point. She zoomed in to show how the little blue shuttle fell into the blind spot and the long seconds it would stay there. "This is the window," Bobby said. "It doesn't look like a trap, because we aren't trying to hide. We get there first, and we're just part of the traffic. So all we need is a lure. Something so critical that the Tempest will follow it where we want it to go. That will be the Storm." She let it sink in. It was like she could see the implications settling in each face looking toward her. It was a sucker punch. One shot, and if it failed, each and every one of them would be dead. The Underground would lose its only warship with Laconian tech. "I'll captain the shuttle with Rennie as tech specialist. Jillian will be in command of the Storm." That made her second sit up a little straighter. Her jaw was firm. She looked like a hunting dog that had caught a scent. "The Storm's mission is to hold the Tempest to this course, so that the shuttle stays in the enemy's blind spot." Alex, sitting to the side, leaned forward. His hands were on his knees, and his eyes were cast down toward the deck. She didn't know what he was thinking. "If anyone doesn't want to do this," Bobby said, "I'm not going to force you. We have 4 days before the shuttle is ready and the orbits are where I want them. I will be accepting resignations until that time. No sugarcoating. This is the most dangerous thing we'll have ever done. If we win, we may sustain losses. Potentially heavy losses. But each and every one of you has my word that if I thought this was hopeless, we wouldn't be doing it. I have sent detailed briefs to your team leaders. Look them over. If you have questions, for fuck's sake, ask them. We're not going to screw this up because someone turned left instead of right. Understood? There was a ragged muttering of assent. I said, "Am I understood?" The reply was more like a cheer now. It filled the space. There was power in it. "Outstanding. You have your orders. Dismissed." Jillian was out of her seat in a moment, herding the crew like they were sheep, nipping at them. It was something she'd have to get over before she had a command of her own. Bobby let it play out, though. There was an energy in the ship that needed to work itself through. She felt it, too. Back in her cabin on the storm, she put herself through the routine of cleaning and straightening her things. The cabin didn't need it, but she did. The ritual calmed her. She found herself humming. She didn't know how long it had been since she'd done that. She needed to go back to her little campsite and clear out all signs of her occupation. But she waited anyway. She'd almost decided that Alex wasn't going to come talk with her when he knocked at her cabin door. "Hey," she said.
"Naomi said it was a good idea?"
She didn't go that far. She might have just thought it was the right bad idea for the moment. Alex managed a little smile. His melancholy made her feel almost ashamed of her lightness and anticipation. "If you need to step back, no one's going to think less of you. Kit's your son. Being part of his life, and this too, if you've got to pick one, I'd understand."
"You left out a part of the plan. What happens after the payload hits?"
"We've never done it before. So apart from an explosion that makes a nuke look like a firecracker, I'm not sure what I'd say. The Storm's a tough ship, though. Even if there's some debris hit, she can take it, probably."
"You're going to want to get that shuttle behind something, though," Alex said. "Put me on it. I'll get it to shelter."
"I need you on the Storm. Keeping the Tempest where I need it, when I need it. It's going to take a great pilot. That's you. Rini and I will be in power armor. The shuttle might get shredded, but we'll be better protected than it will. And you'll be there to come pick us up." Alex shifted his weight. She could see him looking for objections, the way old married couples could see when one wanted the other to pass the salt. "I don't like putting us on different ships either," Bobby said. "But this is the right way to do it."
"Yes, Captain."
"All right," he sighed. And then, to her surprise, grinned.
"This is going to be one hell of a rodeo."
"They aren't going to know what hit them," Bobby said. "My only regret is that Trejo won't be on the ship when we blow it into hot, fast dust."
"We can find him later," Alex said. "I'm going to go obsessively run diagnostics on systems I know are solid so I can feel like I have control of something."
"Sounds good," Bobby said. "I'm going to stay here and see how many of my crew quit rather than go through with this."
"There won't be any. These people will still follow you when you lay siege to hell. We trust you."
Then, a moment later,
"I trust you."
The door closed behind him, and Bobby sat on her crash couch like she was easing down into a warm bath. When she closed her eyes, she slept.
Chapter 31. Teresa. Was Timothy ever really my friend? Holden sat on the cot, his back against the wall. The paper gown he wore was crumpled and streaked with old blood. The sclera of his right eye was blood red, and the flesh around it swollen. The cheek below, puffy and dark. More than that, there was a carefulness to his movements that meant everything ached. The cell was tiny. The smallest closet in her bedroom suite was nearly twice as large. The only light came from a pencil-thin strip at the top of the wall that was too bright to look at directly, but left most of the room too dark to read in.
"If he said he was your friend, then he was," Holden said. Amos wasn't a man who felt the need to lie very often.
"Why was he here?"
she heard herself ask, just the way she'd been told. Holden swallowed like it was a difficult thing to do. He seemed sad. No, not sad. Pitying. It was worse.
"They asked me all this before. I'm sorry that they're making you do it, too."
Trejo had told her to stay on script, to only say what she'd rehearsed, but she took the chance now.
"Maybe they thought it would be harder to lie to someone you'd hurt."
"Maybe.
I'll tell you the same thing I told them. I didn't know he was here. I hadn't been contacted by him. I don't know what his mission was, or who put him onto it, or how long he's been here. If he had a way to get in touch with the underground, I don't know what it was. And I don't know why he had a backpack nuke, except that I'm guessing he at least wanted to have the option of blowing something up. If I'd known he was here, I'd have told him not to."
Teresa looked up at the camera. Holden had answered her next four questions without her asking them. She didn't know if that meant she should skip that part or make him say it all again.
"How's your father?" Holden asked into her hesitation. "No one told me, but I put it together that something went wrong. Plus which, he hasn't come to question me. I feel like he and I have enough of a relationship he would have."
"My father's fine," she thought. She couldn't bring herself to say it.
"Don't worry about him. Worry about yourself."
"Oh, I'm on that. Plenty worried for both of us. All of us."
"What happened to his body?"
she asked, trying to get back onto the script.
"Your dad's?"
"Timothy's."
"I don't know."
She paused. Her gut was tight, and she felt a knot at the back of her throat. She felt it often these days.
"He's dead. I saw it."
"So they've told me. He was a good... well, he wasn't really exactly a good person. He cared enough to try, anyway. But he was loyal as hell."
Holden paused.
"He was my brother. I loved him."
"What is the underground doing?"
Holden shrugged.
"Trying to make enough room under your father's boot that anyone else's opinion matters, I assume."
"That's what I'd be doing." "Hold on, just..." Holden levered himself up and spoke directly to the camera. "Could we cut this part short? It seems kind of shitty for her, and it's not going to change anything."
At first, there was no reply, then the hard clack of the magnetic door bolts opening. Holden sat down. Teresa felt the thrill of relief that told her how frightened she'd been, alone with this man. How glad she was that this part of the ordeal was over.
"They wouldn't have let me hurt you," Holden said, "even if I'd wanted to. I mean, I don't, but even if."
Rage shot through her, unpredictable and vicious. "You're not much of a dancing bear anymore," she said.
Holden leaned against the wall, let it hold him up. When he smiled, she saw that one of his eye teeth was missing.
"Nice to be taken seriously, though."
The door opened, and two guards came in with Colonel Illich. Their boots squeaked on the tile floor. The guards had their hands on their batons, but they didn't draw them. Not yet. Illich put his hand on her shoulder, and she turned to go out.
"If he said he was your friend... then he was."
She wanted to believe that, but she didn't.
"It's okay," Illich said as the cell door closed behind them. "You did well."
The magnetic bolt shot closed again. Holden was contained. She felt a little calmer. They walked down the hallway past half a dozen more doors like it. If there were people behind them, Teresa didn't know who they were or why they were there. It seemed like every day revealed some other vast area of things she didn't know. Ever since the bad night, she'd felt more than a little like a prisoner herself. Trejo had made her go over everything she knew about Timothy, how they'd met, what he'd said, what she'd told him, how he got along with the repair drones, why she'd never told anyone about him. After hours of it, Illich tried to call a halt, but the interrogation had gone on until she was weeping, and then well past that, too. She didn't know how long it had gone on. More than one session, but whether that had been hours or days, she couldn't say. There was a timelessness to everything now, like it had all just started, and also it had all gone on forever. She felt like a puppet of herself, controlled by someone else. Whether she was being badgered by Trejo, or sitting with what was left of her father, or at meals pretending that nothing was wrong, she felt like her real self had been pressed into a small, black place where her heart should have been. Illich had talked to her about trauma and violence, and promised her that with time she would be better. Cortázar had taken over her medical care, scanning her brain and drawing her blood, but he didn't speak to her much. That was fine. She didn't want to speak. When she slept, her nightmares were all violent. She never slept without nightmares anymore. The observation room was a soothing, neutral green. The air smelled of cleanser and the pepper and vanilla of Laconian flowers. Trejo and Cortázar were at a volumetric display that was spinning a complex data pattern like they were watching waves or weather formations. The guards took their places outside the door. Illich went to stand with the two other men. Teresa thought about going to a chair, but it seemed too far, so she folded down to the floor. "What am I looking at, Doc?" Trejo said. Cortázar shook his head. "His response patterns are always a little off. All this noise is within error bars for him. You see something similar in people who've had extensive psychedelics, but usually women. But I'd say changing the questioner didn't affect his reading significantly at all. Given his baseline, I'd say he's telling the truth."
"You're sure about that?"
"No," Cortázar said. "But 80% confidence. We should try it with Dr. Okoye next. He has a much longer association with her. And they're friendly. If you want to pull her off her present work," Illich said. Trejo made an impatient sound and pressed his hands into his cheeks hard enough that his knuckles went pale. There were dark patches under his eyes where the exhaustion was settling in. "He is the only thing holding the Empire together," Teresa thought. It felt like hearing someone else say it, someone who might be lying. "Has there been any result on this search for the body?" Illich asked.
"No," Trejo said. "I've given the shoot on contact order, but I have bigger fish to fry than alien zombies lurching around the landscape. If he does turn back up, he won't have access to his supplies. Maybe we'll get lucky and the drones will decide he's really a table lamp."
Something moved in Teresa's mind. Something small. Cortázar grunted.
"I think you should reconsider that. Having an additional subject would make my work with the High Council much..." "We'll wait for Okoye's report before we change any of that," Trejo said. "The important thing is keeping the separatists under control."
"Really?" Illich said. "I thought the important thing was that something ate our ships and broke Duarte."
He meant her father, but that was fine. It applied to her, too, and it made her feel like she was more included in the conversation, given his baseline.
"That's our second problem," Trejo said, "and we'll get to it. But if I can't keep this together, there won't be anything for the High Council to control when he's recovered."
The hollowness in his voice seemed familiar. Teresa looked at Trejo more carefully. The hours of questioning still left a coloring of humiliation in her, but his weariness and fear weren't hard to see. She'd lost her father. He'd lost his leader. His distress almost made her like him. Like she'd been hauled back in time, the top of Timothy's head came off. She gasped, and was back in the normal time again. Trauma memory. Illich had talked to her about flashbacks to moments her brain was having trouble integrating. He'd told her to report if it happened. It happened, and she didn't. Trejo glanced at her, then Illich. You need to get her back to the state building in time for her peers to see her. Illich stiffened. Respectfully, Admiral, there's more than enough disruption to account for some deviations in the schedule. No one is going to look twice at her being a little bit late to her class. That's my point, Colonel, Trejo said, leaning on the syllables of Illich's rank a little harder to point out the difference. When everyone thinks the flood's coming up, each little bit of normalcy is a sandbag. She may not be the thing that keeps this from getting out of hand, but she can be one part of it. And she's finished her part in the doctor's little test with the prisoner. We don't gain anything by having her here. He meant, we don't gain anything by having you here. Illich kept his composure, and Teresa let herself smile. This new dynamic had come between the men since the bad night. Teresa saw it, even thought she understood what it meant. Illich was part of the innermost conspiracy to keep her father's condition secret. Trejo had trusted him. And then it turned out that Illich had been letting her sneak out of the state building compound to spend time with an assassin for the underground. Trejo had given Illich his trust, and then found that faith hadn't been justified. Or maybe it was just that everything looked like that to her now. Understood, Illich said, then to her, I'll take you to the class. It will be all right. Teresa wanted to burst into tears, or scream, or drop to the floor and flail like a baby. She wanted to throw a table over and scream the way Elsa Singh had. There were too many years of training and expectation holding her in place. She nodded and rose to her feet. But when Illich started to walk down the corridor, she didn't follow. 80%, she said, turning to Cortázar. You're sure? Of 80%. Trejo's eyes flashed a sharp annoyance, but Cortázar seemed happy to answer.
Well, of course, that's just an estimate. But autonomic function has been something of a passion for me these last few years, and there's a lot of very good work done on the brain activity that comes with memory, as opposed to the activity associated with inventing new information. It's possible that the subject created and rehearsed a set of lies, so that's what he's remembering. But since new questioners and novel questions aren't finding any areas that deviate out of recall and into the creative functions, 80 is an estimate. Maybe even a low one. Holden is very probably telling the truth, as he knows it.
If he said he was your friend, then he was. In her memory, Timothy looked up at her the way he always had and said,
You can't have too many tools.
She didn't know which one she'd been, friend or tool. She didn't know, and she needed to. Peer class was in the State Building's museum, wide, pale walls with white lights that showed every color in the paintings and sculptures without making them fade over the years. The air was controlled here, neither warm nor cold, neither humid nor dry. Colonel Illich shepherded them past the great works of other ages like it would be impolite to wake them. He had murdered Timothy, fought with Trejo, carried the weight of the Empire on his back, and his smile and voice were exactly the way they always were. She wondered what else he'd hidden from her over the years. Connor and Muriel were standing next to each other, looking at a canvas of a man painted almost life-sized. His hands were open at his sides, his face lifted as if he were staring at something in the sky. Instead of clothes, a silver sheet was pressed to his body, concealing nothing. Teresa stood with her arms crossed. The painting was so detailed she could see the individual hairs on the backs of the man's hands. It was too perfect to be a photograph.
It's called Icarus at Night, Illich said. The painter was a man named Kingston Tzu. He was the first great artist of Mars. When this painting came out, he was almost deported back to Earth. Can anyone tell me why?
Teresa felt the others glance at each other and at her. She didn't know, and she didn't care. Her mind felt like it had been sandblasted. There wasn't anything there.
The sheet?
Sean Ellison said tentatively.
Yes, Illich said. That's what old medical graft material used to look like. And the man, you'll notice, is dark-skinned. The early history of Mars had a great deal of proxy conflict between the nations that had founded different colonies. This model that Tzu used was from a place called Pakistan. The artist was from a place called China, that was its enemy at the time. The two were at war. Showing an enemy in an explicitly healing and erotic context was very dangerous, politically speaking. Tzu's work could have put him in jail, or in forced labor.
Or the pens, Teresa thought. But that wasn't right. They didn't have pens before the protomolecule.
Then why did he do it?
Teresa was almost surprised to hear her voice.
He thought it was important, Illich said. Tzu felt that all humanity was part of a single family, and that differences that divide us are trivial compared to the deep uniting factors that bring us together. That's why your father brought this painting here. The unity of the human project is a Laconian ideal.
It was a strange thought. They were torturing Holden right now over political differences. They'd killed Timothy, and maybe Timothy had come to Laconia to kill them. And now, here they were, all pretending that a long-dead man's barely concealed penis was a symbol of how much they were all in it together. This was stupid. It was worse than stupid. It was dishonest.
Illich, maybe sensing her mood growing dark, started moving the seminar on to a collection of sculptural abstracts that had only recently arrived from Baragaon. Teresa was just starting to walk toward them when Dr. Cortázar appeared, smiling around a corner.
Colonel, the older man said, here you are. I was wondering if I could borrow Teresa for a few minutes. Routine medical scan.
It caught Illich off balance. His carefully built demeanor shifted, and she saw the flash of annoyance in his eyes, even anger. It made her want to side with Cortázar.
It's okay, she said. I can review on my own later.
Illich's smile slid back into place.
I don't know that... Cortázar took her hand.
It won't be long. Right back. Everything fine.
As she let herself be led away, she felt something like joy or anger. A little ember of rebellion still red and hot in the ashes of her world. She tried to hold on to it. Cortázar was humming to himself. He seemed so pleased he was almost skipping. She waited until they were safely out of earshot before she spoke. Is everything okay?
Perfect. Lovely. I have some ideas about what happened, you know, with the High Council. There are some tests I want to run.
Baselines?
Cortázar's smile widened.
Something like that, yes.
They walked together through the state building and to the private medical wing. The guards all knew them. There was nothing that would raise an alarm with anyone. Teresa had to trot to keep up with Cortázar's long strides. Nothing felt at all off until they walked into the medical suite, the same one she'd been going to for her annual checkups and occasional maladies for longer than she could remember, and Elvi Okoye was sitting at the doctor's station. Even then, Teresa didn't know what was wrong, except that Cortázar's mood soured instantly.
Dr. Okoye, I'm afraid this isn't a good time.
I found some notes I need to clarify with you, she said.
This isn't a good time, Cortázar said again, his tone of voice growing harder.
The rebelliousness and warmth in Teresa's chest shifted into something more like dread. She didn't understand it, but she trusted it.
You should keep an eye on me,
Holden said some time back in her memory. It was connected to Cortázar's voice.
Nature eats babies all the time.
If there's something critical going on with Teresa, Elvi Okoye said, maybe we should let Admiral Trejo know about it. The moment stretched. For a moment, Teresa was back in the cave. Timothy told her to put her hands over her ears. She was breathing too fast. The world started to sparkle at the edges, so bright it was just like darkness. Cortázar looked at her.
You can go, he said. We'll do this another time.
Teresa nodded, turned, and began the walk back toward the museum and her peer class with a sense that something important had just happened. Something dangerous. And she wasn't sure what it was. Chapter 32. Bobby.
Copy, copy, White Crow. Flight path amended.
You good to go, Sasa?
Heard and acknowledged, Bobby said. Thank you, Control.
The tight beam to Callisto's traffic control center dropped, and Bobby shifted the little skiff, feeling the gentle pressure as the thrusters fired. It wasn't even enough to move her crash couch, but it bent the trajectory of her ship just enough. The display had a hard lockout that let her overlay the path of the whole plan without fear of anything leaking back. Where the tempest was, where the storm would appear, and where she needed to be. She stretched her hands, and the powered gloves of the Laconian armor shifted with her. Blue showed through gaps in the black paint job. Blue and black were the wrong colors, and always would be for her. Her armor was supposed to be red. She opened an encrypted tight beam and waited the seconds as it was confirmed. Everything was happening so close in, there was hardly any light delay. This wouldn't be either strategic or close quarters, but the messy part in between.
Captain, Gillian Houston said, we have approval from traffic control. Monitor our position and stand by for go.
Copy that,
Gillian said and dropped the line. It was good discipline, not leaving the connection up longer than required. Not that it would have made much difference now. By the time the Laconian forces tracked the signal, it would be all over, or at least too far along to stop. The White Crow was a terrible little ship. Even if Bobby hadn't been taking it into combat, she'd have wanted to have a vac suit buttoned up tight. The cloth covering the bulkheads was pale, with lines of white showing where age and radiation had degraded it. The crash couches were lumpy and stiff, and slow to react to changes in the ship's vector. The handholds on the walls had all been polished by generations of touching, the way stone steps were supposed to be worn away in medieval cathedrals back on Earth. It was a ship that had outlasted its time, but its drive still worked, and Bobby didn't need much more than that out of it. She waited through minutes that felt long as they passed, and sudden when they were gone. The outward pushing, inward pulling dilation of time before battle. It felt good.
How are we down there, Rini? She asked.
The response delay from the airlock wasn't much less than when she'd been talking to Callisto.
I feel like I'm cupping the devil's balls, Rini said. But yeah, it all looks good.
Bobby had looked over the torpedo before they'd taken off. It was the smallest and fastest that Bobby could find. Black and boxy and hardly longer than her own leg. Rini had stripped the already spare design down to its minimum, taking away the mass of the traditional warhead in order to win a few extra milliseconds when the burn came. Instead of blowing the little fusion core, the proximity sensor would disable the power that kept the antimatter cut off from the rest of the universe, and physics would take it from there. Bobby just had to get it close. She checked the flight path. The White Crow was just about where she wanted it to be.
I'm about to pull the pin, Bobby said. If you need a potty break, now's the time. Rini's laugh was short and humorless. I've been pissing myself since you told me the plan, Cap. At this point, I'm amazed I don't have a prolapsed bladder. Only a little longer, she said, and switched back to the tight beam. Status?
At your order, Jillian said.
This was the moment. The last moment. Bobby could pull back now. Take the White Crow through her planned flight path. Tell her crew to scatter to the winds. Drop the antimatter down Jupiter's gravity well and enjoy the fireworks. There hadn't been a lot of decisive moments in her life that she'd recognized when they were happening. Usually they only came clear after the fact. Take her out, Storm, Bobby said.
Done,
Jillian said, the single syllable sharp and hard as a thrown rock. Bobby took a deep breath, let it out. Down on Callisto, the gathering storm was coming to life, breaking out of its hidden berth and leaping through the thin Callistan atmosphere toward the stars. Her crew were being pressed back into their couches, like God had his palm on their chests. All she could do was sit and listen to the open channel, and wait for someone to notice a drive plume where there shouldn't be one. The emergency alert cut through the chatter of voices. Military orders to make clear. The thickly traveled Jovian system, with its dozens of moons and millions of people all smashed down into a volume smaller than the slow zone, had just become a battlefield. She fired up the White Crow's drive as if she were going to head for shelter. Her body felt warm and smooth. On her tactical display, the Tempest shifted the way it was supposed to, took the vector she'd anticipated, leaped to the attack. When she switched to visual, it looked like a tiny bone, dark against the brightness of its own drive plume. The display showed fast movers, torpedoes already in flight from the storm, and there, tiny pinpricks of light where the Tempest's BDCs were firing out through holes in its skin-like plating to knock them back. The thin cone of the enemy's blind spot swept across the tactical display. She'd be in it soon. Very soon.
Make safe, Rini, she said. We're about to get bumpy. Not soon enough for me.
The White Crow fell into shadow, and Bobby spun the ship hard, throwing the drive into a hard burn. The crash couch slammed up into her back. Her armor flashed a medical alert error up as her blood pressure fluttered, then took it down when she stabilized. The tactical screen had more targets than she could track. Jillian Houston was throwing everything the storm had at the Tempest, and the Tempest was opening up its own volley. But so far, no sign of the magnetar field generator. So their dangerous gamble was paying off, for now. Bobby slid the White Crow closer in, trying to narrow the gap between her and her enemy. The burn was hard. Her armor rippled down on her legs and arms in rhythm with her heart, pushing the blood along, keeping it from pooling. Even so, darkness started to creep in at the edges of her vision. She was aware of voices on her radio, like they were music coming from another room. She was hiding in the middle of the Tempest's blind spot. The safest she could be in the middle of a shooting war, and still not particularly safe. She shifted to the in-ship comms, and the rest of the universe went silent. Prepare for launch. She was pretty certain she heard Rinny's grit-toothed acknowledgement. She checked her drive. 7 Gs. She'd done worse than 7 Gs before. Getting old sucked. She didn't just feel the impact. She heard it, transmitted up through the mass of the ship and into her armor, a deep, dull clank like someone hitting a badly made bell.
I think we took a hit, she said. What's your status?
Rini didn't answer. Pushing against the thrust gravity, Bobby shifted to the network display. Rini's power armor was still connected, but everything on it was in error states. A sea of red, where green should have been. Bobby shouted the woman's name again, but she already knew there wouldn't be a reply.
The airlock was one deck down, and then half a dozen meters from the lift shaft. If she cut the drive, the White Crow would fall out of the blind spot and be cut down by the Tempest's PDCs. If the torpedo had broken, if it had broken, she'd already be a rapidly expanding cloud of glowing plasma. The antimatter, at least, was still intact. That meant there was hope. And if there was hope, there wasn't rest. She slaved the piloting controls to her armor, checked her seals and status, a few medical stats in the yellow but nothing in the red, and unstrapped from the crash couch. The power armor whined under its own weight as she stood, and she felt her shoulders trying to dislocate. The blood in her veins slammed down into her legs, and the armor clamped against her thighs, pushing it back up. A wave of nausea almost overcame her. She took the first of 8 steps to the lift. She could do it. She had to. A low growling was coming up from the deck. The maneuvering thrusters were firing. That couldn't be good. She reached the lift, and the slight reduction in G as she went down was like one drop of water to someone dying of thirst. It stopped when the lift did. The airlock was a mess. Both sets of doors were open, venting the ship into space. The bulkhead was folded where the PDC rounds had hit. Jagged holes gaped where the raw kinetic force had shoved the outer hull into the room. The torpedo was in the far corner where the bulkhead met the floor, and Rini's body was beside it. Bobby went to her side and knelt, the artificial muscles running through her power armor straining under the burden. Death had come fast for Rini. She probably hadn't even known it happened. The armor was the same mostly black as Bobby's, and it was still working hard to preserve the life that was gone. 5 holes across her back and arm poured blood too fast, the thrust gravity squeezing it out of the corpse. Bobby shifted Rini away. There'd be time for mourning later. Rini had protected the torpedo from the worst of the damage, but the little drive wasn't unscathed. A white impact showed where a bit of shrapnel had cracked the ceramic around the drive cone. Bobby tried to lift it and see the extent of the damage, but she couldn't. Even with the powered armor, the burn was too much. Her spine ached, and the one rib that dislocated when she was under too much thrust had slipped out of place again. It hurt to breathe. The White Crow threw up a fresh alert. The maneuvering thrusters were at a little under a third of the reaction mass, and requesting permission to start drawing from the reserve. It only took seconds to see the problem. The PDC rounds had sheared off a section of the exterior plating. In a larger ship, it wouldn't have mattered, but the White Crow was small enough that it had shifted the center of mass. The thrusters were firing to keep her from curving off, and would until they ran dry. She had the ship open a tight beam to the storm.
"Need good news, Captain,"
Jillian said, her voice wet and phlegmy from the pressure of their burn.
"Rini's down. Ship and torpedo are both compromised. I need you to make the Tempest stop. I can do this, but not at a high burn."
There was no response for a second.
"How?"
Jillian asked, but Alex's voice cut in on the channel.
"Give me a second, Bobby. I'll get you what you need."
She closed her eyes. Her consciousness was swimming. It was only force of will that made her turn toward the payload. The 4 little spheres of magnetism, vacuum, and hellfire. The proximity sensor. Neither of them looked damaged. She checked her tactical display. She was still in the blind spot. She rotated the ship and eased back on the maneuvering thrusters. If she was going to fall off course, she could at least fall in the right direction. The Tempest's drive plume swept past, framed in the airlock doors like a comet.
"Alex," she said, "give me something."
And, as if in answer, the White Crow went on the float. Bobby rose up, then clamped mag boots against the deck. The Tempest's drive plume was gone. Her blood shifted, and the nausea came and went again as she unhooked the warhead and the proximity sensor. The White Crow was spent.